So, if you're a visitor here, as has already been said, you're very welcome, but you won't know that we've been looking through a book in the Bible written by Jesus' brother, a man called James. And it's a very short little book, it's right at the back of the Bible, and we've just been looking at it a little bit each week, and we're just going to look at it a little bit this morning from chapter 4 of that particular book, James chapter 4. And I'm just going to read a little bit and then have a little thought and read another bit and have a little thought, and then they're going to stop. So you can look forward to that. It doesn't start in a very promising way, this passage, so let's just read it as we get going. This is how it starts. What is causing the quarrels and fights among you? Don't they come from the evil desires at war within you? You want what you don't have, so you scheme and kill to get it. You're jealous of what others have, but you can't get it. So you fight and wage war to take it away from them. Yet you don't have what you want because you don't ask God for it. And even when you do ask, you don't get it because your motives are all wrong. You want what only will give you pleasure. You adulterers, don't you realize that friendship with the world makes you an enemy of God? I say it again. If you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy of God. Now, I don't know what your experience of church life is, but this kind of points to something fairly fractious going on in this church that this little letter is written to. James uses all the language of warfare to describe their relationships. You're at war with one another. He even says you scheme and you kill. I'm fairly sure this is an exaggeration. I'm not sure that literally they were killing one another. But clearly there was something deeply dysfunctional within their relationships together. They were at loggerheads, they were squabbling, they were after what they wanted at the expense of what other people wanted, and they were willing to kind of really fall out over it. There was something quite ruinous going on in their relationships together. And the passage points to the heart of that ruin. Where does that ruin come from? It points to the fact that it comes from the evil desires that are at war within you, saying that you only want what will give you pleasure. What the passage points to is something quite profound, which is that within the heart of every human being, there is so much good, but there's also a bias towards bad. I don't know if you've ever played the game of bowls. Anyone played the game of bowls? Yeah. So you know in the bowl you have the sort of roundish bowl to roll, and it doesn't roll in a straight line, does it? No, it doesn't. Because on one side of the bowl there's a little piece, little weighted piece. That means that the bowl always goes in a crooked line. I once played a game of bowls at Yates Sports Centre where there are lots of rinks or lanes or whatever they're called. As you can tell, I'm not a professional. And I was playing with somebody who just couldn't get the hang of this particular little bias that's in the bowl. And every time he bowled his bowl, it ended up on somebody else's pitch, which for the first couple of times was quite funny. But after a little while, they did get rather annoyed with the fact that his bowl kept going across there. But there's a bias built into this thing. And the Bible kind of indicates that that's the same with us as human beings. There's a bias built into us, which, when we're under pressure sometimes, when we're at our weakest sometimes, it leads us to stuff that really is unhelpful. Unhelpful for others, unhelpful for us. The Bible has a little word to describe it. It's the word sin. It's the ability to fall short of what we really want to do. You know, sometimes we act out of character. We use that language to describe. We act out of character. You're not normally like that. And we say, what's got into her? Acknowledging that there's something inside of us which causes the problems that we generate and experience. There's something ruinous, a little ruinous bias that's built within us, which leads us towards this destructive behavior, which sometimes hurts us, sometimes hurts others. But the passage also says it has a significant impact on our relationship with God. Don't you realize, the passage said, that friendship with the world makes you an enemy of God? The world is just the way that everybody else does life. That's what it means. Wanting to be like everyone else, wanting to do things the same as everybody else, taking your script for your life from the way that everybody else lives. Don't you realize that just living life the way that everybody else lives it is not necessarily going to make you a friend of God? Notice what the passage doesn't say. It doesn't say that it makes God an enemy of you. God is no one's enemy. God loves everyone. But what the passage does say is that your behavior can make you an enemy of God. You've turned your back on him. You're living your life selfishly. You're just after what you can get out of life, living the life that everybody else is living without thought about whether or not it's the life that God wants you to live. It's a ruinous place to be in. It damages you, it damages others, it damages your relationship with God. As Dad's Army might say, we're doomed. How do we get out of this bias, this mess, this personal ruin that we find ourselves in? Well, the passage goes on to say this. Do you think that the scriptures have no meaning? They say that God is passionate that the spirit he's placed within us should be faithful to him. There's something inside of us that God longs to have right with him. And he gives grace generously, as the scriptures say, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That word grace is one of the most profound, important, vibrant, powerful words in all of the Bible. Grace is about something which God has, which he gives to us, which we could not get ourselves, that we don't deserve, that we could never earn, but that God decides to give it to us anyway. Grace is God's super abundant life that we have failed to live, but which he wants us to have. There's something in us that God longs to have back. And he wants to give us the resources to live the life that we should have lived. And if naturally we find ourselves in a place of ruin, God comes to our rescue. The most powerful story of grace in the Bible is probably the well-known story of the prodigal son, the boy who said to his dad, I want my inheritance now so I can go off and live the life that everybody else is living. All my mates, they've got big cars, they've got flash wives, or maybe flash cars and big wives, I don't know. They're living the life of Riley, and I'm stuck here at home with you, Dad. I want to go. So his dad generously gives him the inheritance that he's due, and he goes off and he lives the life of Riley. He ends up spending all the money and ends up in a place of ruin with nothing left. And he concludes that if he goes back to his dad, then maybe his dad will take him back in as a servant. And he's got this little speech worked out in his head. Many of you know this very well. So this little speech worked out. He's going to go home and he's going to say to his dad, Dad, I've blown it. I'm sorry. If you'll take me back as a servant, then I can come back into your household. At least I'll have somewhere to sleep and something to eat. And we're told that before he could even get back to the family home, his father, who'd been watching out for him, comes running down the road, which is an entirely undignified thing for a Jewish father to do. And he hugs his son. And he says, son, I don't want you back as a servant. I want you back as a son. Come into my house. We'll have a party. I've got some nice new gear for you to wear. That's grace. It's given the impoverished, ruined life something that they don't deserve and could never get for themselves. The Bible's full of stories of God's grace. One of Jesus' best friends was a man called Peter. He lived with Peter for 3 years. He taught Peter everything. He laid down his life for Peter. And at Jesus' most excruciating moment, when he was about to be executed on a Roman cross, Peter said, I don't even know who that guy is. I have nothing to do with him, because he was so fearful of being caught up in the same death that Jesus was dying. Completely turned his back on God. Completely turned his back on his friend Jesus. And yet we read just a few days later, Jesus comes to Peter with no words of condemnation, no attempt to sort him out. Well, you really blew it, didn't you? Call yourself my friend. We need to get a few things sorted out. Nothing. Just, do you love me, Peter? Should we get going where we were before? Grace. The good news of grace is you can never fall so far that you fall beyond grace. You can never run so far that you've run beyond grace. You can never sin so much that you sin beyond grace. You can never have caused so much ruin and experienced so much ruin that you find yourselves outside the boundaries of grace. God's grace comes to us to rescue us from the state that we find ourselves in. So what do we do then? Well, the passage finishes like this. So, submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Come close to God, and God will come close to you. Wash your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, for your loyalty is divided between God and the world. Let there be tears for what you've done. Let there be sorrow and deep grief. Let there be sadness instead of laughter, and gloom instead of joy. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up in honor. Notice, you probably were counting as I was reading, there's 10 commandments there, there's 10 instructions there. Don't try and look more than now, but there are 10 instructions. Stop it. There are 10 instructions there. The fact that God gives us this new life, this grace, this welcome, this hug, this embrace, this forgiveness, doesn't mean that we don't have to respond in some way. What God gives us is free, but we are called to respond. And the response is wholehearted. The language is language of submission. Submit yourselves to God. Resist the devil. Turn away from the life you used to live, the world that was influenced by the world around you, and that bias within you. Turn away from that. Submit yourselves to God. It's not just going paddling in a bit of Christianity on Sunday mornings. Dive into the thing. Dive in. That's why baptism, as we baptized, is it baptism by immersion, because we're baptizing not just the person's heart or the person's hands or the person's feet, but everything about the person. Now, the word submission can be a negative thing to some people. When I grew up, wrestling, proper wrestling, was on the television. Not this new fancy American version, but proper English with Mick McManus and Giant Haystacks and people like that. And my grandmother, who was quite small and very, very frail and very, very... She used to love Mick McManus. This is a complete mismatch. Anyway, in a wrestling bout, somebody would get somebody in a headlock on the floor and they'd be struggling for breath. And they say, submit, submit. Is this the image that the Bible wants to give us? God's got us in a headlock, submit. No, it's not that at all. The better illustration is the submission that comes in a marriage. Baptism is, in one sense, an underwater wedding. It's an underwater wedding. It's one person saying to another, I submit my life to you. The person being baptized is saying, I submit my life to you, God. I'm diving into this thing called Christian faith. I'm diving in head first. Well, it won't be head first, but I'm diving in from the top of my head, my thought life, to the soles of my feet, where I go and what I do, to my hands. Everything about me is going to be immersed in this desire to be God's person. In a wedding service, sorry if this is a painful memory for some of you, but in the wedding service, the bride and groom actually say to one another, with my body I honor you. All that I am, I give to you. And all that I have, I share with you within the love of God. Those words could be fantastic baptismal vows. As this person publicly commits themselves to Jesus Christ, they're saying, with my body, all that I am, I honor you now. All that I am, I give to you now. And all that I have, I share with you. Isn't that sinister? No. Is a wedding sinister? No. It's a beautiful expression of love as one person wholeheartedly gives themselves to another. And baptism is a bit like a wedding service in that this is the public moment. This is the moment when these people go public with their confession of faith. At a wedding, you don't expect that the husband and wife had just met one another on that day, randomly walking past a church and been brought in. No, they've built a relationship. They've learned to love one another. They've learned what one another's like. But they get to a point where publicly they want to make a covenant with one another before friends and family. And in a sense, that's what's happening in baptism, in this underwater wedding. Somebody has fallen in love with God and they've received the love of God, the grace of God. And they get to the point where they say, actually, publicly, I want to make this thing something I own before the world, not just own privately in my heart. They want to honor God's invitation to come close to him, knowing that he will come close to them. There's also a response of sorrow in that reading. Let there be tears for what you've done. When the person is immersed in water in baptism, it's a sign of their regret for the life they used to live. The life that didn't pay any notice of God and God's desires. A washing clean. A moment of remorse and regret for what's gone before. A determination to turn away from that life. And there's a response of standing in a new life. The passage finishes with these words, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up in honor. That's resurrection language, that is. That's new life language, that is. That's something new appearing. God will lift you up. And after the person has been immersed in water and they stand up, they're standing up, as it were, into a new life. Just like the married couple, when they leave the church, they're leaving into a new life. So the people standing up are standing up into that new life that God wants to give them, the grace life, the God life, the Jesus-shaped life. There's a response of submitting to God, of sorrow for past, and of standing in this new life, which just starts today. And of course, there'll be ups and downs. Don't expect, if you're a friend of the person being baptized, that they'll be perfect from this moment on. Let me tell you for sure, they will disappoint you. But they started on a new path, a path of life with Jesus Christ. And the question is not, have you arrived at the destination? The question is, which direction are you now traveling in? They haven't yet arrived at the destination, none of us have. But by being baptized, they're saying, I'm headed in a new direction. So, three words from that short passage. A brief reflection on the ruin that sometimes we find within our own lives that causes damage to us and to others and to our relationship with God. The wonderful grace of God that comes to rescue us and the response that he calls us to make of living our lives now for him, as will be symbolized through the baptisms we're about to see.